Legally Blonde, Suits, My Cousin Vinny.
All badass lawyers, all different.
Which begs the question, what type of lawyer do you want to be?
Don't waste another second thinking, ugh, I don't even know what types of lawyers there are.
Trust us, we've been there.
Let's put a stop to that once and for all.
Go take the 90-second quiz from New Lawyer Now What coach Angela Vorpal to give yourself a clear picture of the best fit type law for you.
Go to www.whattypeoflawyerquiz.com and take the quiz today.
Once you've taken the quiz, send us a DM on Instagram to let us know what type of lawyer you got. We can't wait to hear. Hi, guys, and welcome back to the Ladies to Law podcast. I'm Sam.
And I'm Haley.
And this week, we have a very interesting episode with Micah Star Liberty. She is a trauma survivor lawyer, essentially. And she's going to go into more detail in the episode, but there is a trigger warning. We are going to be talking about sexual assault and murder and other things like that. So, you know, if this is not for you, it's okay. We'll see you next week.
But if it is for you, let's dive in.
Please help me welcome our guest, Micah Star Liberty. Hi, Micah. How are you?
Hi, Sam. I'm great. How are you doing?
I am great, and we're very delighted to have you here today. So why don't you go ahead and tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
So I worked in politics before going to law school, and the reason why I went to work in politics was because of something that happened to me when I was in high school. And it's I want to give a little bit of a trigger warning. One of my dear friends, I was a ballerina and went to a performing arts school in San Diego, and so was my friend Amber. And during my senior year of high school, Amber and her mother were raped and murdered by a serial killer in San Diego. His name is Cleophas Prince, and he is still on death row at San Quentin. And at 17, I didn't really know how to process what had happened and couldn't wrap my head around violence against women in the way that I saw it play out for Amber and Pam. And I committed my life the day after her funeral to helping victims of crime, victims of domestic violence, gender violence, sexual assault. I didn't even know what I was really committing to, but I decided I would spend the rest of my life trying to help this community because I saw how tragic of an end it was for my dear friend who had a very bright future and her young mother. So I went to work in politics because I thought working at a public policy level, working federally, would provide me with the best outlet and the best path to really change laws, to hold perpetrators accountable, and to provide protections for the victims and the survivors. And I worked in Bill Clinton's White House as an intern. At the same time, Monica Lewinsky was an intern. So it was a bit of an education with respect to how work environments can also be, toxic in terms of discrimination and inappropriate behavior. And then I decided, I want to do this on a micro level now and help individuals rather than try and accomplish something through massive public policy. So I went to law school and started working on behalf of victims and survivors soon after graduation. And I've been doing that for 23 years now.
Wow, that's really exciting. I can't wait to talk more about that. So tell us where you went to law school and, you know, what that experience was like.
I went to a UC school in San Francisco. The school actually just changed its name recently. It was called UC Hastings. But like a lot of institutions, research was done and they realized that Hastings was not a good guy. And so they changed the name to remove Hastings. So now it's called UC Law School San Francisco, which is kind of a mouthful. But here in California, all of the UC schools have graduate and undergraduate programs, except for two, the medical school in San Francisco and the law school here in the Bay Area in San Francisco.
So what made you choose to go to San Francisco?
I was born in San Francisco. I was born in a communal building in the 70s. You don't get a name like Micah Star Liberty without having some hippie roots. and my father's family is here in the Bay Area. and I knew that I wanted to practice in California, and I thought it would make the most sense to practice, to go to law school in the area that I thought I would want to practice in. So that's what I did. And also they accepted me, which is a huge part of the equation.
So once you got to law school, you probably had, you know, your vision of kind of what you wanted to be right afterwards. But what did you do in law school to like make that happen? Were there certain internships you did or classes that you took to, you know, propel you forward?
There really wasn't anything specific to like the equivalent of an undergraduate women's rights or women's studies type of curriculum. And I don't think most law schools have that even now, which is something I'm working on developing a training and some curriculum. So law schools can have clinics or elective classes to learn about human trafficking, prosecution, and sexual assault cases. You know, things were really not as wide known or developed prior to the Me Too movement. And I went to school in the 1900s. So it was a long time ago when I started law school. And we just didn't think about women's legal rights in the same way that we do now, thankfully. I mean, I'm not suggesting it's perfect, but back then there really wasn't a discussion, you know, on the civil rights of 50% of the population. So what I did was just get every sort of real world practical education that I could. I worked when I was in law school because I wanted to apply what I was learning in my evidence class. And I externed for a federal judge, and I worked in a workers' rights clinic that, the law school put on. So I really just tried to get out there and get my hands dirty as much as I could. And I continued to do volunteer work at a rape crisis center in San Francisco, just to, you know, stay connected to that kind of support work that was important to me.
So once you got out of law school and you took the bar and all that, what was your first position?
I went briefly back to a plaintiff's law firm that I had worked at during law school. And so they were on the side of the pleading paper that I wanted to be affiliated with, but they did all kinds of personal injury cases, class actions, a lot of really systemic change cases. Which was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. I learned a lot, and I'm still very close to a lot of people at that firm, but I wanted to work on sexual harassment cases and sexual assault cases for adults and children. So I went to a firm that kind of specialized in that area and was there for 4 years, and then decided, want to do this how I want to do it. And I want to be more victim-centered and not as focused on the business piece of it. I mean, that's important when you run a law firm, certainly you have to keep the doors open. But I wanted it to be what I now understand to be trauma-informed, but I didn't even really know what that was back then. I just intuitively wanted to make sure I was helping survivors go through the process in a way that wasn't further traumatizing to them.
So after working at the plaintiff's law firm, what was your next step? Like, what did you decide to do?
I wanted to open my own firm. So that's what I did. I, in hindsight, was quite inexperienced and, you know, had only tried a couple of cases, but I thought, I want to do this the way I want to do this. I want to make the arguments that I want to make, and I want to interact with my clients in a way that feels good to me and feels protective of them. So I just went out on my own and I thought, oh my God, the phone's not going to ring. I'm not going to get any cases. You know, no one knows me yet. All of those insecure thoughts when you're at the precipice of making any leap like that. And I was pleasantly surprised. I think, you know, a week in, I thought I was going to be checking the phone to see if it was plugged in because it wasn't ringing, you know. But a week in, I got asked to step in and do a trial to cover someone else's trial. So, you know, and I haven't looked back and I've been busy ever since.
Wow. So, you know, you said you haven't looked back. So how has your career looked like since then? Like, what do you focus on in a day in, day out basis? Like, who are your clients and how do they find you?
Well, at this point, after doing this for 23 years and having a number of high profile cases and leadership roles in my community, in the plaintiff's bar, people just find me. They've either read my name, which is memorable to some. They've either read my name in the paper associated with the case, or they've, you know, a lot of it comes from word of mouth. I will confess that a lot of opposing counsel who hate me going through the litigation will then turn around and refer cases to me because they know that I'm going to fight like hell for any survivor. And, you know, I've had defense lawyers send family members to me. So, you know, it's just one of those things that kind of grows and spreads naturally. I don't do any sort of advertising or anything like that.
So would you say that most of your practice is like trial work, or how, like, what does that look like? What's a day to day?
You know, I wish we went to trial a little bit more in these cases because the stakes are so high. Oftentimes they resolve and the allegations are so heinous against the defendants. So we don't get to trial as much as I would like to. I think it, you know, the rates are probably similar to any sort of general civil case. And I think it's something like over 98% resolved before trial, but, we do, prepare for trial in every single case, if that's what, you know, has to happen and that's what the client wants to do, we'll try any case that's in our office.
And I guess, who are you necessarily, you know, when you're starting a lawsuit on behalf of a victim, who, like, is it companies that you're suing? Is it their employers? Like, who, what is the situation there?
We'll be right back.
Hey guys, we want to take a moment to talk about something that has been a game changer for us busy lawyers, Audible.
Yes, Audible has been our go-to platform for incredible audiobooks, offering an extensive library of thrillers, nonfiction, autobiographies, and mysteries.
And guess what? We've got a special treat for you. Audible is offering a free trial to our listeners, and all you need to do is check the link in the show notes. It's the perfect opportunity to experience the magic of audiobooks without spending a dime.
Speaking of thrillers, I know you are currently hooked on Never Lie by Freda McFadden. Samantha, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Absolutely. The twists and turns in Never Lie have kept me on the edge of my seat during the workday and even when I'm on my daily walks. It's like having a suspenseful companion wherever I go.
And for those looking for some financial wisdom, I have been engrossed in My Money, My Way by Kamuku Love. It's packed with practical advice on managing finances, perfect for anyone trying to navigate the complexities of money management.
What we love most is the flexibility Audible offers. As lawyers, our schedules can be unpredictable, but with Audible, we can enjoy our favorite books on the go, whether we're stuck in traffic, hitting the gym, or waiting for a court hearing.
So, if you're ready to embark on a literary journey and discover the joys of audiobooks, click the link in the show notes to start your free trial with Audible. Trust us, you won't want to miss out on this fantastic offer.
Yeah, you name it. It's individuals. If there are assets, and that's probably a whole nother conversation about, you know, how to deal with sexual assault cases when the perpetrator doesn't have assets. But we sue employers, we sue youth sports organizations and leaders, we sue schools and school districts. Sadly, wherever there are children, you're going to see child sexual abuse. That's where the perpetrators go to find access to their victims. Any sort of institution, you're going to see discrimination, bias, and worse, sexual harassment, and oftentimes coupled with sexual assault. We also sue social media platforms for sex trafficking or trafficking of what used to be called child pornography, but is now called child sexual abuse material. Revenge porn cases, that kind of thing. And unfortunately, most of the sexual violence that's happening now and the human trafficking, both image-based and in-person, is happening on our social media platforms and on the internet.
So would you say like a majority of your clients are they people that stuff happened to them maybe when they were younger and now they're coming forward? Or do you find that minors are your clients and or stuff like that? Like how does that work? Because I know like a lot of times people don't necessarily want to just like start a lawsuit as soon as something happens to them, right?
Exactly. And thankfully, because we've had a lot of reform with respect to sexual assault statutes of limitations, now in most states, there's either a window that's open to revive claims that have been time barred because they missed the SOL because they were children, or they can only focus and are only ready to deal with what happened to them in litigation now. So we do a lot of cases in both respects where it's a child and the parents learn of the sexual abuse or trafficking. And so we use the parents become the guardian ad litems. They make the decision for the child, but we are trying to remedy and get accountability for what's happened to the children. But yeah, there are a lot of adult, what we call child victims and adult plaintiffs. So they're, men and women in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, who were abused as children, who are now coming forward. Because the attitude has changed a lot. People understand that this is real and really happens and causes a lot of harm. That's exactly right. Any sort of, you know, YMCA type of organization, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, religious organizations. I used to keep a list of different religious organizations that I had sued, and was like a bingo game for me. I wanted to get them all because it happens everywhere, every single type of organization where there are children, perpetrators are going to go, and there's not enough training. There's not enough oversight. And they're not vetting folks well enough. But the other area that I think is important, and a lot of parents don't expect, but medical providers. If you have a child in a room with a medical provider and you're not chaperoning it, the visit, or there isn't a nurse or a medical assistant or whatever, I have seen so many medical doctors, dentists, you know, RNs, orderlies commit atrocious crimes against children in the medical setting.
So my next question was going to be, like, what are the biggest challenges that you face when you're suing these entities? Because I'm sure, you know, it's kind of like he said, she said, right? Like, a lot of times I'm sure there's not like concrete evidence, or maybe there is, right? So what do you find are some challenges?
Yeah, particularly with the older cases, a lot of times, you know, if you're suing a, you know, a Boy Scout entity somewhere for a crime that happened 30 years ago, they're going to have destroyed the records, maybe nefariously, or maybe just in the normal course of doing business. We see that a lot for older cases. So finding prior complaints, because we have to prove notice, that the entity was on notice, and prior complaints are the best way to do that. And if they have been destroyed, you know, it makes it very, very difficult. But I will tell you that what you learn to study are the patterns. And when you have a predator, I always say in my office, people don't go from 0 to 60. It's not, you know, a law-abiding, respectful teacher who then turns around and rapes a child in a classroom, right? There's grooming that goes on with the individual victim. And there are also usually other incidents that have happened before. And one of the most beautiful things about the sexual assault survivor community is they want to do whatever they can to make sure that type of behavior doesn't happen to anyone else. So when we get a little attention on a case, like a newspaper article or a TV, you know, news spot, people will reach out and say, I remember Father so-and-so, and I remember hearing stories, or I experienced X, Y, and Z. So we still are able to prove our cases. But yeah, I mean, when you're talking about something that was 30 years ago or 40 years ago, and sometimes in those cases, the child victim, now an adult plaintiff, doesn't remember the last name of the perpetrator because they just called him Coach Steve or whatever it is. So there are definitely evidentiary challenges, but, you know, that's what 20 something years of experience teaches you, how to go and find out who else knows some information and, you know, have them come forward to help, and people are willing to do it.
So what do you think, you know, like you said before, law schools don't really have classes that might teach you or expose you to these kinds of roles and this kind of work. So what do you think law schools, what kind of classes could they be offering, you think?
I think clinics, folks could be working in DA's offices if they want to work on the criminal piece. Also, in California, we were the first to develop and pass, it's actually a constitutional amendment here, that crime victims have rights. And so it's called Marcy's Law here in California. Federally, it's called the Crime Victims Bill of Rights, and almost every single state has some version of it. And so as a civil lawyer, I will go in if I have a case and it's working its way through the criminal process and represent my clients pursuant to Marcy's Law. That's something that the DA's offices sometimes use advocates, you know, DA advocates to help with, but law students could, you know, do the same kind of work. So I think a clinic would be great, and just starting to learn and understand the law, because so much advocacy in sexual assault comes with an obligation or a need to do advocacy in legislatures. So lobbying, meeting with local elected government officials, and helping educate society at large about the incident rate, what's actually going on, laws that could help people, you know, if used in practice, because we have a lot of laws on the books, but they're not all helpful because they weren't written by people who understand sexual assault.
So if any of our listeners want to, you know, get involved with this kind of law, and, you know, maybe they're survivors themselves and they want to, you know, can they reach out to you and like have a chat?
Absolutely. And actually, I'm in the process of writing a book called Evolutionista, which is about kind of the practical nature of sexual assault litigation. It talks about, you know, how you explain the discovery process to clients. How do you help people? I kind of refer to it as the what to expect when you're expecting, but for sexual assault litigation, because survivors don't understand. It's their first interaction with the civil justice experience, you know, process usually. And we just need to start explaining everything a little bit more broadly and making it more accessible.
Well, it sounds like there's options and different things that you can do.
The other thing I think law schools should do, and this applies, I think, to any practice area, is developing trauma-informed litigation practices or trauma-informed legal practices, because at this point, everybody that we come into contact with has had some form of trauma. And even if you represent a corporation and you think, well, I'm not representing a person, the corporation, organizations can have trauma. And there's a ton of social science on this and how it impacts the structure of the organization and the actual humans who work at the organization. So, and litigation is stressful no matter what role you play. So just explaining to people how to develop more of a do no harm approach to litigation or law in general, I think would be really helpful. So they can find me at libertylaw.com. But what I also decided to do a couple of years ago was to create additional companies, because I was doing so much kind of mentoring and volunteer work through my law firm. And just to keep things a little bit more separate for myself in my own mind, I created a training company called Lionhearted Leader, and I do free trainings on how to be trauma-informed, how to approach DE&I from a trauma-informed perspective. And then also I created a company called the Soaring Center, like a bird soaring, to do basically mentoring, volunteer work. I will help other law firms prepare their clients who have trauma to testify either at deposition or trial, because I've learned, you know, through trial and error, how to get them to be focused. Because when you're having a trauma response, your executive functioning shuts down and you're not going to get good or the best testimony from that witness. So there's a way to work with them so they can stay kind of at baseline and not go into a trauma response or not disassociate. So through those two companies, I do a ton of free advocacy, legislative lobbying, that kind of stuff, and also mentoring.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you both for having me. And I'm, you know, I was so thrilled to learn about two women who went to law school together, who are now doing a podcast for women in the law. It really, it was exciting and warmed my heart to see you out there supporting other women in our profession. So thank you.
Thank you, Micah. We appreciate it. Have a good one. Wow. I mean, great, great person. I mean, she's doing great work. She's helping survivors. I mean, I feel like so much news that I have consumed as of late has involved different organizations that have done wrong, or serial killers, or serial rape, you know, just these different things. And then to know and to meet someone who is helping those people, it was just such an honor to have her on our show.
Yeah, and I totally agree that more law schools should have clinics and stuff like that. I mean, it's especially nowadays, right? Because I think now more than ever, like you said, we're seeing it all over the media. Just because I do think that people are maybe starting to feel like they can speak up for themselves.
Yeah.
I think it was a great episode. I hope you guys learned something, and I hope that you're inspired to, you know, help out survivors as women.
Absolutely. And if you enjoyed this episode, the best compliment you can pay us is to recommend our podcast to a friend. Also, don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen so you never miss an episode.
Yes. We will talk to you guys next week. We love you. Stay safe and healthy. And yeah, talk to you soon.
Bye, guys.
Bye.